Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Earlier this week, The Lancet Respiratory Medicine published a randomized trial on whether haloperidol, in fact, is useful in preventing or shortening delirium and coma in critically ill patients. The data show that the widely used drug has no meaningful effect on that outcome. Along with that report, the journal published a commentary by Dr. Joanna Skrobik, an intensivist who is holder of the Lise and Jean Fain Chair in Critical Care at the University of Montreal and a member of the Faculty of Medicine at McGill. Welcome, Dr. Skrobik.
Thank you.
Usually, I interview the authors of studies and not the commentators, but your remarks were intriguing. I'm speaking in particular about your final question, which is, we should be asking ourselves, are we treating the patients or our own discomfort? So that question almost verges on medical heresy, no?
I'm not sure. There are a few particularities about patients who are in an intensive care unit. The first is that all of the staff members, the physicians, the nurses, the students that work there, the respiratory therapists, there are a lot of disciplines of caregivers, want to make sure that nothing goes wrong with the patient. It's perhaps not a good analogy to say that it's a little like the stewardess telling you to sit down on an airplane because she's concerned about your safety, but there's a huge emphasis on tubes that are positioned in the airway or other potential determinants to your well-being and to your stability that might become displaced. So people who are physically agitated or who are disoriented enough to be pulling at those tubes are a ubiquitous source of concern for critical care caregivers. Mm. But I think the part that we never talk about is the discomfort that we face when we're looking after somebody who doesn't make eye contact and who doesn't recognize that you are the caregiver. So if you have a patient in the intensive care unit who makes eye contact, recognizes, nods that they know that you're the physician, and agree or disagree with their body language if they can't speak or speak to you and say, thank you, doctor, for instance, then it establishes a very comfortable relationship. When you have somebody who is thrashing, who's looking at the ceiling and appears to be in a movie that it's different than the reality that you're experiencing, mm-hmm. it makes the caregiver uncomfortable. And there are studies looking at the effect that delirium or agitated delirium has on families and on caregivers. And Bill Breitbart, who's a psychiatrist in New York City, has published a fair amount of work on this, showing that the nurses of delirious people, as well as their family members, experience an incredible amount of distress when the person that normally recognizes them becomes agitated, inappropriate, or doesn't have the same kind of contact mm-hmm. that we would consider as being normal. And there's a component of that that's the discomfort of that person not recognizing you, and part of it that is a discomfort of not knowing what to do. So it's a little, and part of it is feeling responsible or maybe not, or not, you know, not knowing how to handle it. So it's a little like the beggar on the street that you make a circle around, right? You don't want to come forward and engage because it's an awkward and new state for somebody who shouldn't be behaving like that.
You write that delirium does not seem to be associated with psychological sequelae. So
in ICU patients, that's some people say that it is, mm-hmm. And some people say that it is associated with cognitive sequelae. And the short answer is we're not sure, because the way we screen for delirium is not quite as consistent as it could be in other patient populations that don't have five other things going on at the same time, and the whole question of how you measure outcomes. But globally, people who get delirium tend to be sicker, and probably, you're right, do not have more psychological sequelae, but certainly it's not clear that they have psychological sequelae.
Right. But in order to prevent, either the caregiver's discomfort or to prevent other things, we're still, they're still being, the patient's still being treated with drugs.
And sometimes
those drugs have adverse effects. And so you mentioned that there are some non-pharmacological measures that can reduce the occurrence of delirium. What are some of those?
Before I answer that question, I'd like to say that overall, over the last 20 years, we've really been giving patients a lot of calming drugs in the intensive care unit. And what we're starting to understand now is that giving patients sedatives without necessarily addressing the delirium issue is actually harmful. So to have somebody who's very asleep or very calm and not responsive is something that will make the caregiver feel better because they look comfortable, but is associated with more sequelae for the ICU patient.
Okay.
But when you look at psychiatric disorders overall or psychological distress, there are a lot of examples where pharmacological intervention is not that effective. So if you look at something very common like depression, if you were to treat all depressed patients with drugs alone, you wouldn't get very far. And the type of drug that people respond to is variable from person to person, and psychotherapy sure helps. And when you look at all psychiatric illnesses, there isn't one where non-pharmacological intervention is useless.
Mm-hmm.
So in depression, even in schizophrenia, to add a component of psychotherapy, reassurance, and other non-pharmacological interventions makes a huge difference.
I see, even physical reassurance.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the case of delirium, the only thing that's ever been shown to prevent delirium is physical therapy in the intensive care unit. So if you start physiotherapy within 36 hours of ICU admission and try and get people sitting up and out of bed if they're able to tolerate being out of bed, you reduce the incidence of delirium by half. And patients have much better outcomes and need a whole lot less drug when they're in intensive care. So that's a non-pharmacological intervention. And how much of it has to do with the fact that they're moving? And how much of it has to do with the fact that there are three more people around them encouraging them and reassuring them that they're doing this so that they can get better and go home? So they're not sitting there paranoid and fearful that they're going to die and that all of these people around them are going to harm them. Which one of those is it? We don't know, right? But it's completely removed from any pharmacological intervention. And when I was a younger staff physician, and particularly when I was a resident and a student, there were many more orderlies, and the intensive care units were staffed with more nurses. And that human resource element meant that if somebody developed agitation, the first thing we used to do 20 years ago wasn't necessarily to give people medication, but we would try and see whether we could distract them from their agitation so we'd get them out of bed. And I remember one patient who would be very agitated and pulling at all of their tubes who would only settle when the orderly would pull out a pack of cards. And so every day the orderly would come and play cards with this patient. And I think that those are things that we don't even consider now because intensive care units are staffed to the minimum for, you know, cost-effectiveness ratios. But that whole, let me talk to you and see why, what it is that you're upset about, can I reorient you, can I reassure you, can I make you believe that all the people around you aren't evil and trying to harm you, can I reassure you that you are going to go back to being a normal person, because when you wake up with hallucinations, you don't know that you're not going to stay that way.
Yeah.
And it's a very frightening perspective for the person who doesn't get asked whether they're hallucinating or not, and who doesn't then get reoriented or reassured in some way. And in all qualitative studies where people are asked to tell the story of their delirium and the story of their agitation, there's always a component of reassurance that comes from somewhere if someone takes the trouble to do it. So I think that that's a completely under considered aspect of delirium care.
Now, the patients in the study that you were commenting on, though, were all on mechanical ventilation, which would mean that they wouldn't necessarily be able to get up and move around easily. Correct.
Well, that's not true. We used to keep people in bed And in the same way, you know, 15 years ago, if you had cardiac surgery, we were put on bed rest mm-hmm. for a week, just because, or 20 years ago, because people thought that you were so fragile. Yeah. And what people started to understand in the cardiac surgery patients is that if you get somebody out of bed within 24 hours, they're going to do a lot better than if you keep them in bed. Less clots, less complications, less pain, less infection. And the same change in paradigm is coming finally to the intensive care unit. So being on a mechanical ventilator does not mean that you cannot not only get out of bed and sit in a chair, but it also means you can walk around.
Well, that's a reflection of my 40 years ago experience as a lab technician.
No, but I think it's very important because Dr. Schweikert and J.P. Kress and Jesse Hall's group in Chicago published their study on early physiotherapy in the intensive care unit a few years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, and their patients were mobilized on mechanical ventilators and on inotropes. So these were people who were very unstable from the cardiac and circulatory point of view and from the respiratory point of view. And what they showed is that if you mobilize people early, that the ones who survive go home instead of going on to dependent care, which is what happens when you muscle waste because you haven't been moved until you're ready. You know, so there's that. So the prevention, but also the human contact involved with the idea of mobilizing somebody. Two dimensions, somebody's touching you and somebody's encouraging you and is telling you that they're doing it so that you can get better and go home. So that's the psychological support component that I think we're maybe not all that good at.
It's only been about 36 hours since your editorial comment was published, but have you had any reaction to it from colleagues?
Yes, I have. Some of them called and said, we're not surprised you're questioning the party line, but I think the paper is a very important paper because we've been giving haloperidol to patients who are delirious on wards and in intensive care units for the last 25 years. It's the most commonly used drug in critical care and for agitation and for delirium across Canada, across the U.S. and It's important to say we tested it and it doesn't work, because the corollary is that we also have believed for years that benzodiazepines, so drugs like Ativan or Valium, are not good because we thought that they caused delirium. And our group published a study in Critical Care Medicine last April where we looked at delirium and we looked at serum drug levels. And in the patients, in the 100 patients that we looked at, we unequivocally showed that there's no relationship between benzodiazepines and delirium. And people, in fact, who developed delirium tended to have gotten much less benzodiazepines. So what it does is it opens the field. So you don't know that something, I mean, you now know that something that you've used for 25 years doesn't work. But if you were going to approach pharmacological management, there's a much broader palette of choices. So antipsychotics like haloperidol don't work. There are other categories of antipsychotics that might or might not. But the cheapest drug remains benzodiazepine. And I think what this paper allows a thoughtful physician to do is to say, okay, let's see whether non-pharmacological approaches work, because it doesn't look as if you're going to change what happens to the patient if you give them drugs. So maybe you can try without drugs, because the less drugs you give, the less side effects, the less interactions. And if that doesn't work, then I have the choice of either giving a benzodiazepine, which costs under $1 a day, or giving another kind of sedative or another category of sedative, or maybe I can, you know, see if the patient has other non-pharmacological approaches that can reassure them and not necessarily go back to a drug that we now know isn't effective, doesn't change outcome.
Now, if you could be dictator of medicine, what would you recommend that intensivists do differently as a result of the study, besides staffing up ICUs with aids, with decks of cards.
I think the key is not the deck of cards. I think we spend very little time communicating with our patients about their individual needs. Mm-hmm. So one person's very different from another, right? Some people are phlegmatic and approach illness and life-threatening illness very philosophically. Other people don't. And most of who you are, if I were to ask your family, who is he, even if you were very sick in an intensive care unit, they would be able to describe who you are and what reassures you and what frightens you, or people who love you, it doesn't have to be family, mm-hmm. that and then be able to describe how I could make you better in all sorts of ways that have nothing to do with pharmacological intervention. Huh. So I think that there's a clear role for pharmacology in conventional medicine on a long list of diagnoses. You know, if you don't give antibiotics within the first hour of a severe infection, you're not really doing that good a job. But I think in terms of the psychological and psychiatric spectrum of symptoms, I think that if we try dialogue and try understanding the patient's needs, I think that we will use a whole lot less pharmacology and maybe do the patients a favor. So there are two papers that support the non-pharmacological approach, mm-hmm. and a very holistic dimension. There's one paper that was published by an Italian group that looked at whether it was useful to have a psychologist come in and coach the nurses, the patients, and the families when the patients became delirious in trying to reassure them. And people got delirious as often, but recovered faster once they came home and the families didn't get as disturbed or as distraught, yeah. by the delirium, with a psychologist helping everybody through this difficult period. Mm. And the other paper that I thought was interesting, and these are all soft interventions, was a UK paper where nurses taught families how to reassure the delirious patient. And everybody did better when they did that. So, you know, here's this person that, you know, you are used to knowing as your father. They don't recognize you anymore. They're behaving in an inappropriate manner, in an unusual manner for them. And you are engaged in helping them get back, mm-hmm. to who they were before. And so it keeps you busy, but it helps them, and everybody heals better. So those are the kind of interventions that I think we should be a whole lot more aggressive with.
Okay.
And if I could impose it, I would.
Do me a favor and send me, if you could send me just the some links to those two papers. I will put them on the website so that listeners can
I'd be delighted. I'd be delighted, because these are simple, cheap things, but I do think they make a big difference. You know, when people leave intensive care, what a lot of us don't realize, and I think what is challenging in the trajectory towards primary care, right, because you have primary care clinicians who then end up with all of these extremely vivid experiences, both on the part of the patients and on the part of the families, mm. and the continuum isn't straightforward for anybody. And I think that some of those suggestions are useful for people who work in primary care, who look after ICU patients or who look after their families while the patients are still in the ICU, so that they can come back with these, you know, gentle suggestions as to how to make it easier for everybody. But I think this type of intervention is really useful.
Well,
and it's my clinic, you know, I've been a little bit, I think the only advantage of being older is that you've seen and thought, and so my clinical observation is that the non-pharmacological part is a huge component in making people feel better, and in my opinion is a whole lot better at getting people settled down than giving them drugs.
I want to thank you so much for spending time
us
today, Dr. Skorbut.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I'll send you the information.
Thanks again. That was our 166th edition. All earlier conversations can be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.